You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, making friends as an adult can be tough, but friendships are critical to our well-being. A psychologist shares the science of making friends when you're a grown-up. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, it can feel like we have more access to political leaders today than we've ever had in the past. If you hop online, you can reply to a tweet from the President of the United States or hear from them directly on Facebook or YouTube or you name it. But is online engagement the same thing as civic engagement? Our next guest took a closer look at that question and how the digital world has reshaped American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you engage with politicians online? Do you do politics one way or another on social media? Do you follow elected officials or candidates? Or would you like to hear less of them when you turn on your phone or your computer? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Elizabeth Losch is a professor of English and American Studies at William and Mary. She's the author of several books, including her latest. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
One of the things that really struck me about the book is how much things have changed. You started in about 2008, and the Obama campaign is this innovative thing where they send a personal text or email to somebody, and people are excited. Like, wow, they're reaching out to me directly. Now, here we are just 14 years later, and we're like, enough with all the personal text from politicians. Can you talk about, first of all, just what a moving target this is in the political world?
Yeah, it's certainly during the start of the Obama administration, there was a lot of optimism about how technology could bring us more direct digital democracy. And there were these promises that you could be connected to the president, that you could participate in crafting legislation and policy, that you would have all kinds of new forms of access, and that data would be more transparent than it ever has been before. They promised to kind of get rid of all these intermediaries standing between you and your political leaders. And that optimism really turned around in the last decade. I think partly because the overreach of big tech companies running search and social media brands obviously are compromising our privacy and probably our free speech as well, and certainly our decision-making capacities. So I think that this kind of Obama optimism about technology really had took a darker turn. And I think Trump really took advantage of that. Although in the book, I argue that Obama and Trump actually have a lot in common.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Obviously very different in many ways, but that idea that you were just talking about of, hey, I'm a politician and I have this way to reach out directly to voters and the media doesn't get to interpret it or put context around it or critique it. That's going to be very tempting, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can bypass journalists, you can bypass elected representatives, you can bypass all kinds of gatekeepers who otherwise control your message. So it's very appealing. I think the other very appealing aspect is you can really slice and dice the data and you can make very specific targeted appeals to people, often drawing on their own user-generated content for social media.
What does that mean for us, though, as voters, if we have this, you know, direct outreach from a President Obama or a President Trump? Is it a net gain for us?
I argue that in a lot of ways, it undermines our trust in other forms of representative government, and that we have a tendency to invest too much authority in the leader of the executive branch. And we're not fully developing our civic identities because we're kind of relying on this sort of big celebrity persona that we're relating to through showing our own proximity or kind of feelings of connection to that person.
We're talking to Elizabeth Losch about her new book. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Prescott is with us in Lake Geneva. Prescott, hi.
Hey, you know what? I just wanted to bring up another point about the celebrity politics, and that's kind of what the games turn into, to where they can create these clickbait, you know, Twitter posts that really engage their followers, and they get reposts, and I think it's poor for politics and politicians, because now it's just become a chanting game so much, and just to rile up the whole nation, and you're losing touch with people in your representative community.
Prescott, thanks for the call. Elizabeth Prescott brings up, I think the quality of the communication we get from politicians who might be, you know, trying to get clicks like an influencer, not trying to serve us as an elected representative.
Yeah, Prescott makes a great point about the relationship between kind of clickbait and some of these forms of digital communication. It was funny to be researching the book and notice how much the style of presidential Twitter changed from the beginning with Obama to the end with Trump, because Obama often wouldn't actually kind of give us a soundbite that could move through the news cycle on Twitter. So there would be a link to a policy document that would be shared on Twitter, while Trump really had these sort of punchy headlines in his tweets that circulated through the media ecosystem much more rapidly. He was kind of a genius at live tweeting different kinds of public and political events.
Thanks for that call, Prescott, at 800-642-1234. Part of the story you tell is about how the media did, the reporting type media did and didn't keep up with what happened on social media. And that question is like, is a presidential tweet, you know, newsworthy? Does it deserve an article? Can you talk about efforts of the traditional media to understand this new political social media landscape?
Yeah, I think the traditional media still struggles to adequately cover what's going on in social media. I think just things like the ways the media covers TikTok, which I write about toward the end of the book when I'm writing about the Biden-Kamala Harris campaign, certainly shows its inadequacies. But, you know, one of the interesting things about the ways that the media covered social media from the presidential candidates is that they often wanted to project a particular kind of presidential authority. So, for example, Donald Trump used emojis hundreds of times in his tweets, and yet you would never, ever see those tweets on the network news. It was always something that was much more in keeping with the network news cycle that would get reposted. So in the book, I do a kind of deep dive on the kinds of tweets, you know, Trump composed over 50,000 tweets, right? There are a lot of tweets there. And I try to kind of look at the kinds of tweets that don't get media coverage. And yet those tweets might be very important to his followers. It's a way to build that community around the Trump message.
You also talk about that idea of digital communities, or at least what feel like communities that can form around a candidate, a political identity, or even conspiracy theories. And again, this is something that's really changing in the period you're covering, still changing now. Talk about what you see in these communities.
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing that Trump did with Twitter very successfully, is sort of hinting at a potential conspiracy without actually sort of stating its premises or any, you know, supporting evidence about it. And I think that's, one of the features of these conspiracy theories is they often, you know, use partial information as a way to get people emotionally invested in a particular kind of story. But it's funny that, Barack Obama began his political career by creating a personalized social media platform, mybarackobama.com. And now we see Trump with his own social media platform, Truth Social, which, of course, has had some challenges in the marketplace because it doesn't moderate the content that might be tied to some of those conspiracy theories.
We're talking to Elizabeth Losch, professor of English and American Studies at William & Mary, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen the internet and social media changing our politics? Do you converse with people online about politics? Do you argue with people online about politics? Have you seen a positive outcome, a way that social media helped you connect and maybe make a difference in the world? Or do you see nothing but negative? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Elizabeth Losch about her new book, Selfie Democracy, the New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do politics online? Do you converse? Do you argue on social media? Have you had to block people on social media because of political discussions spiraling downhill? Are you, in this midterm election season, overwhelmed by all the ads, all the emails from candidates and campaigns and outside groups? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth, one of the things you talk about in your solutions chapter toward the end of your book is changing our culture of what we mean by civic participation in the digital media age. What kind of ideas do you hope start to take hold?
Well, I've also studied activists. My last book was actually about hashtags and the ways that people can get their messages out using social media by using hashtags more effectively. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from looking at the world of activism and the ways that people try to manage their own visibility and get a little more control over some of these tech companies. I do think that even though we're a very polarized nation, I think that both Democrats and Republicans agree that something has to be done about the power of these companies. We're talking about how Google and Facebook and Amazon and Apple really do have an outsized influence on our democratic processes. And I think finding that common ground can be difficult because people on the left are much more worried about misinformation, while people on the right are much more worried about censorship. But I think we still can find some common ground when it comes to not only regulating these companies, but also educating ourselves more effectively.
Well, let's take each of those points in turn. First of all, where do you see potential common ground for regulations? And we would need common ground, I think, in Congress to make it happen, for regulations on some of these big social media and search companies.
Well, even though the convenience of customization is something that many Americans have become used to, I think most Americans are getting pretty concerned about their privacy. And so I think that we can actually look to what's happening in other countries, particularly countries in the European Union, as a way to think about ways that we could get more control over how our data is used, and particularly how it's sold to third parties.
And then you said kind of on a more personal level, this isn't something you can do with the law. What kind of thing do you hope that people who use social media are thinking about, are filtering when they're looking at the online political world?
Well, I think that we can all benefit from thinking critically about our own media literacy. I mean, I'm a fake news researcher, and I've fallen for fake news stories. And I think having a certain amount of humility when it comes to our ability to vet sources, I think is something really important. I mean, one of the things I say in the chapter on fake news is essentially throughout human history, there have been crises about fake news, particularly when we have new technologies. So when the radio came in, there was a lot of concern about fake news after Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast. So, you know, we might be just going through another one of those times in which we need to, as a culture, as a society, think about new forms of media literacy.
Talking to Elizabeth Losch about her new book, Selfie Democracy, the New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, as I mentioned earlier, we are in a political campaign season now. The topic of your book keeps on going even after the book is published. What are you seeing this year, 2022, from Republicans and Democrats that evolves the things you talked about in your book?
Well, I think one of the interesting trends is this concern about voting and concern about having ballots being properly counted when we have these digital voting machines. And I think this distrust in technology, which, you know, we certainly saw toward the end of the Trump administration, is something that I think is going to continue to be a factor in these midterms. You know, so far, we're not seeing as many kind of close elections in the primary season, although some of them have been pretty close. But I suspect that when we'll be getting into the general, we're going to be seeing a lot more concerns about can we really trust technology? And I think more concerns about the ways that social media companies might be amplifying some messages and suppressing others.
I think there was a time where we could say, oh, who cares what's happening in social media? That's just out there in the ether. The last word of your subtitle, insurrection, points in another direction. When did we start seeing sort of online communities, political communities forming themselves and showing up in person again?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see how the insurrectionists actually were shooting selfies in the Capitol. And they were sort of seeking that direct participation. You could argue that, you know, during the Tea Party movement, we also saw a lot of this sort of showing up in person, showing up at town hall meetings, showing up at school board meetings, this sort of need to kind of physically be present. But often that physical presence is in response to a digital call to action. So people get a social media post that encourages them to show up at a particular place, and then they shoot images for social media, or they film the event. And so there's this sort of cycle where social media tells us to be present and show up at a particular time and place and in a face-to-face, in-person interaction. And then we document our presence there. We make ourselves visible. And that goes back to the social media ecosystem. And I don't know if we can really disentangle ourselves from social media completely. I'm not one of these people who says, you know, we all need to essentially throw our smartphones in the garbage can. But what I would like to see is more transformation from that in-person interaction as well. And for those in-person interactions not to be so homogenous, for us to be able to, you know, have more diverse coalitions where we're coming together over common causes.
I think, and you touch on this in the book, there's this ideal that, you know, once upon a time, we all had this civic participation. We came together as communities to vote, or at least to voice our grievances in civil ways. I don't know, is this a mythical golden age, or is there something in the past you would hope we could come back to?
Well, I mean, one of the sections of the book, which talks about Obama's digital town halls, does point out, drawing on the scholarship of others, that town halls have sort of never been this kind of idealized performance of civics. But I do think that there are ways that we can do a little bit better. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of cases in the book where well-meaning digital initiatives got taken over by trolls or conspiracy theorists or other people. But I do think that the power of petitioning and the power of in-person protest really can be transformative. I think if you look back on the history of American politics, you'll see that people have managed to effect major changes by virtue of making themselves visible in different kinds of public spaces.
Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Oh, hi, yes. A statement and a question is why the FCC has more regulation on CB radios than any internet regulation. I just bought a CB radio last year for fun, for driving around Madison and on the highways around Madison, and it's been kind of fun, you know, to note an accident or something, and it just seems like we're just all bent out of shape on the internet. No civility.
Steve, 10-4. Thanks for the call. Steve pointing toward the internet maybe being under-regulated. Elizabeth, what do you think?
That's definitely true. I think that because this is a newer technology, there's been a tendency to sort of give it a pass and hope that it contributes enough to our information economy that we'll sort of let it develop without regulation. But as Steve points out, older technologies are much more regulated. Now, the other problem, there's sort of the too little, too late problem with regulation. The Obama administration did have close relationships with Google, close relationships with Facebook, and, you know, really often sort of had a more optimistic and utopian view of technology that made it reluctant to regulate those technologies. And the other thing is the role of lobbyists, because far too often when we're looking at the FCC, what we're seeing is people moving from being lobbyists for cable internet providers, for social media companies. They're coming into the FCC, and then they're going back out into the world of lobbying. And this has happened with both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Steve, thanks for that call. And Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Elizabeth Losch, professor of English and American Studies at William and Mary, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. Social Security benefits are projected to increase nearly 10% next year as cost of living adjustments reflect higher inflation. It's a bit of good news for retirees who depend on those benefits, but it comes as the Social Security system faces a looming shortfall in the future, with its surplus projected to be depleted by 2035, which could lead to cuts in benefits if funding for the system goes unchanged. Current economic conditions can make it challenging to navigate retirement finances, whether you're already out of the workforce or you're planning for it at some point in the future. Our next guest is with us to help us better understand the issues facing Social Security and how we can best prepare for them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you receiving Social Security benefits right now? How has inflation affected you? Are you making plans trying to figure out when to start taking the benefits, you or maybe an older loved one? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Carrie Hannon is a personal finance and retirement expert and a senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. She's the author of a bunch of books on working, money, and aging. Her latest is called In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Terrific. Great to be here.
Let's start off with inflation and how it affects Social Security-related decisions. What are you seeing out there?
Well, yeah. So what's happened this year has been pretty phenomenal, right? The inflation has just been skyrocketing. Now it's settled down a bit, but we had a pretty rough go of it. And I think what we're going to see for especially people who were currently on Social Security, living on a lot of that fixed income, it was a bit of a shock as the prices took off, right? But now we're talking about the experts I've talked to going forward. It looks like we may see the largest increase since 1981 in that Social Security benefit for next year. Now, they don't announce this until October, and it kicks in January. But this could be really a nice savings for the people who have really been, seen a lot of their benefit being eroded away.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned that was a projection. I don't want anybody to write that into their budgets just yet. But can you talk about how that cost of living adjustment works? This is something that the system evaluates every year, right?
Right, they do. It's once a year adjustment, and they do it in October. But they base it on what the inflation, and it's sort of a funny number. It's close to the inflation number we hear about a lot. But the cost of living adjustment for Social Security, it could increase 9.6% maybe. But what it is they look at July, they look at August, and they look at September, and they say, what's the environment out there for inflation, and where should we land? Now, again, the first checks, once they announce that in mid-October, it doesn't take effect until the checks that go out in January. So there's a bit of a lag there.
Now, if someone is receiving Social Security, they get this bump in benefits next year, cost of living, like, does that look like an increase in their income? Does that affect them in other areas, whether it's federal benefits or anything else?
That is a super good question. That the issue is, it can impact. There's a study I saw by the Senior Citizens League that found that 39% of their participants who received low income benefits that they reported for their low income assistance, it would be reduced. And for this year, we had a 5.9% cost of living adjustment. Those people, 39%, had their benefit reduced because of the 5.9% from this year. So yes, indeed, you could lose some access to your assistance programs depending on where you are on that income stream.
We're talking to personal finance retirement expert Carrie Hannon, looking at Social Security, how to manage your decisions related to Social Security, the impact of inflation, and the future of the program. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie, I want to get to that 2034, 2035 a deadline. We hear some pretty dire predictions. I hear some other people say, maybe a minor tweak. What is going to happen in that, in roughly, what is that, 12, 13 years?
Exactly. And that's going to be here before you know it. The truth is, you know, we do need our policymakers to be taking a look at this. And here's what's happened. This is really quite understandable, is because you've got to figure we don't have as many young people coming into the system as the boomers have moved through the system and are now tapping their Social Security benefits. So what they're saying is that it's not going away. You're not going to lose Social Security entirely, but it could be a drop down to 70% of that benefit for, say, millennials and those coming behind after 2034 or 35, whatever, you know, wherever we see that fall. With this big increase, if that happens for next year, it could come sooner, right? So it's very important that they take a look at this and how we're going to fund it moving forward. Because, I mean, it really is that, you know, the income the people are paying in, those are the ones who pay for the people who are currently taking benefits.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us by Pulaski. Jeff, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my phone call. What is the cap where people do not pay Social Security taxes anymore? Is it $250,000,
$400,000? Jeff, thanks for the call. That cap he's referring to, Carrie, if I make up to a certain amount of money, I pay Social Security, I pay into the system. Money I make beyond that, I don't. Where is that line now?
So this is my understanding, okay? If you file federal tax return as an individual and your combined income is between $25,000 and $34,000, you may have to pay a tax on up to 50% of your benefits. If it's more than $34,000, up to 85% of your benefits may be taxable. If you file a joint return and you and your spouse have a combined income that is between $32,000 and $44,000, you may have to pay income tax on up to 50% of your benefit. And more than 44%, it's up to 85% of your benefits may be taxable. And, you know, that's the situation we're in today. Yeah.
Oh, Jeff, thanks for that call. I want to look at the other end of the system for people who are currently paying into the system. How much, there's that, I think, a cap where if you make over $130,000 or something like that, you only pay into the system up to that amount. Do I have that about right?
I think you do. I don't have that number right in front of me, but that sounds about right.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carrie, I think a pretty common question is people, you know, start to get into that neighborhood of retirement ages. Hey, at what age should I start drawing Social Security benefits? What are some of the factors they should weigh?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I'm a big fan of telling people that if you possibly can, bump back tapping into that benefit until you're 70, right? You can get full retirement at your full retirement age, which has been bumped up to between 66 and 67, I think it is, as we've edged up. You can have the full thing, and you can start early, certainly at 62. But to get the full amount of your, you know, benefit, if you can wait till 70, they built in this incentive in the system to do that, and you get 8% annual increase from your full retirement age up until age 70. That's kind of sweet. And it's really worth it if you can, you know, if you can delay those retirement credits, you know, you'll get that 8% annual retirement credit if you can delay you know, taking that, just pause it and don't take that benefit until you reach age 70. Not everyone can do that. That's absolutely true. But the math does work out very nicely for many people if you can stay on the job or at least refrain from tapping into it until you hit 70.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. And Carrie, you've written about this at least leading up to the pandemic. People have been working later, answering those incentives in part. What do you think is driving people to stay in the workforce, you know, later into their 60s?
Yeah, they truly are. And I think that most people, their retirement age, I just saw a Gallup poll that said it's the average is 66, which certainly means that some are higher and some are lower, you know, so that, but the point is people are staying on the job longer. And I think, yes, without question, it's been the inflation we've seen this year. People have been a little nervous about that. They've been nervous about the stock market with so many of us who have 401k plans now, and a lot of our retirement assets are invested in the stock market. And when you see that jitteriness, it makes you go like, whoa, you know, and there were some big drops. And so people thought, you know what, maybe if I can stay on a little bit longer, this is a good thing. And then also the other thing that's keeping people on the job really is this idea that you don't tap into Medicare till age 65, and very few companies now offer retiree health insurance. And so if you can stay on the job where you get health care benefits up until you reach 65, that's a really good strategy, because when you're on your own, it's not so it can be quite expensive for individual coverage. And that is, so it's the medical, it's the inflation, and it's the stock market jittery that has people saying, let me see if I can work a little bit longer.
We're talking to finance columnist and retirement expert Carrie Hannon about the challenges facing the Social Security system and how we can navigate them, make our retirement decisions along the way. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you delayed your retirement longer than you had planned or longer than you see, you know, as the norm, maybe the age your parents retired? What led you to do that? If you're already retired, have you gone back into the workforce? Are you currently making a decision about Social Security, when and how to take it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Carrie Hannon, retirement expert and the author of several books on working and aging. Her latest book is called In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. She's with us today to talk about Social Security, how we can prepare ourselves for retirement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Social Security and retirement planning? If you're retired, are you already receiving benefits or putting it off? Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rich is with us in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, Carrie. I got a question. I took Social Security at 62, and I still work. And I made, I don't know, $6,000 more than I should have. And they penalized me $3,000. And they're taking it out of my check, which is fine. I don't care. But I want to know, is there interest on that or not?
Rich, thanks for calling. First of all, to that basic question, Carrie, is there, does he have to pay interest on that? I don't know if you have that info off the top of your head.
You know, I don't have that info, but the interesting thing is, yeah, that does happen. That earnings test is really, really crazy on many ways, but you don't lose that money. I mean, they're going to build that benefit that they've taken away from you right now. Once you reach age 70, there's no longer the earnings test. So they don't care how much you make after that. But up until age 70, they're going to do that, but they will build the benefit that they withhold from you now, that you know, that 3,000 or what have you that you mentioned, you will get that back. Once you reach your full retirement age, is my understanding. It could be it might be age 70. I need to double check that. I apologize, but you don't lose it. Is the point?
Okay, so good news, Rich, for the long run. Thanks for calling in. Are there things we should think about, Carrie, if we're planning? We're in Rich's situation, taking Social Security in our 60s, still working though. I mean, how do we have to be careful about not making, I guess, too much money?
Yeah, you don't. I mean, you do and you don't. If you're making enough money that if they reduce your benefit, which they're just withholding it, you're going to get it back eventually. If you're making income, it shouldn't be a hardship for you because you are making that income. So you're not relying on that benefit check to meet your monthly nut, right? That's the idea. I mean, they really want the point is to try to discourage people from taking Social Security benefit when they, you know, are still working. And so they want to keep you on the job. That's the bottom line there. And so I think that the important thing to remember is that, yes, look it up. I mean, the IRS has a really good guide to all of this, IRS.gov. They can give you the particular numbers and so forth. But again, there is that earnings limit that you should be conscious of.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to get your response to my three-prong approach to saving the Social Security Administration system. Number one, no more taxing benefits because you're going to be paying them into the system for your whole life. Number two, you pay into the system and your employer matches 10% of your income. So in other words, if you earn $20,000 a year, you're going to pay $2,000 into the system. Your employer is going to match that another $2,000. Then once you start collecting benefits, again, like I said, no more taxing, but also throughout your lifetime, the government should be allowed to take a certain percentage of that money that's sitting there and invest it in the stock market, or like what Obama did when he invested in the auto industry. And then, you know, the government would buy stocks and then purchase and then sell the stocks later and possibly make a profit on them. I think that system would keep our economy going and it would keep people, with money in their pocket.
Jeff, thanks for the call. A lot of ideas out there, Carrie, about how to extend the current life of Social Security. Any thoughts on Jeff's three-part platform there?
Well, I love Jeff's creative thinking. This is what we need. We need this sort of thinking going on here in Washington because we need to make some tweaks. And I think those are marvelous ideas. Particularly, I love the idea of the matching employer amount to pay into it. So that's all. The stock market is interesting. It's a little scary if we have dips like we just had this year. But overall, the market over a 20-year period does seem to outperform almost any other kind of investment.
Thanks for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Social Security and retirement. Our guest is Carrie Hannon, retirement expert, author of a bunch of books on related topics. Back to your calls now with Greg in Green Bay. Greg, hi.
Hi there. My question lies within collecting Social Security at 62 or waiting till 67, which would be my max, so age for it. And when I do the math, if I start collecting it at 62 and versus wait until I'm 67, if you do the math, that extra money that I'll gain at age 67, it would take me till 79 years old to catch up. And then from that point, I would be better off. And that's neglecting any investment interest I would make in those years.
Greg, thanks for the call. Yeah, one tricky thing, of course, about retirement is, Carrie, we don't know how long we're going to live. Right. How do we factor that sort of uncertainty into things?
Yeah, we don't have that crystal ball. So it's really an individual by individual choice. And, you can get a sense of how healthy you are, but we all know anything can happen. I want to make a quick correction. I think I don't know if I said it correctly. That earnings test that we were talking about with the last caller, that goes away at your full retirement age, not at age 70, but at your full retirement age.
All right. And that age, that means what? We've decided to take full Social Security at that point?
Yeah, if you've dipped in, if you're taking your Social Security and you've reached your full retirement age, 66, 67, then you can earn as much money as you want. There's no earnings test then.
Greg, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Tom is with us in Wauwatosa. Tom, hi.
Hello. I am currently 63 years old, and I went on disability 10 years ago. Currently, I get Social Security disability every month, as well as from the teacher's retirement system and from sick pay. But so I don't know when or if that's going to change my Social Security status when I reach 65 or 67, whatever it is, since I'm currently getting the Social Security disability benefits.
Tom, thanks for that call. Carrie, Tom brings up another huge part of Social Security, which is Social Security disability. Do you know if he switches over automatically at some point or has to do something?
I must say, I don't know the nuances of that particular thing. I do know that the Social Security disability program is actually in very good shape health-wise, that it is not one that they're worried about being depleted in any way going forward. But I think he has a really great question there, and I'm sorry I can't give you the specific answer on that.
Tom, thanks for that call. Carrie, I want to get into wider issues around retirement. Social Security is one part of retirement planning. I think for most people, it alone probably isn't going to be enough, right?
No, and it was never really intended to be, Rob. I think it is an important piece. And for many people, it is, in fact, the lion's share of it. But we often think about, that the different stools, the different things that go into this. If you have a little, if you think of it in compartments, you've got your Social Security, you've got your retirement plan, hopefully through your workplace, if you've had either a 401k or if you're lucky enough to have a pension, which has been steadily going away. But that, and then your savings that you've put together on your own are those three things. And I like to put the fourth one being working during your retirement in some way as a safety net, even if it's seasonal, part-time, some kind of, as long as you're able to and you're still curious and you still have relevant skills, if you can keep earning a little bit just on the side, whatever that might be, that kind of gives you that, maybe it's that mad money, but it's the money that keeps you from having to dip into retirement accounts any more than you need to and let that money continue to grow. So it is challenging. And what's interesting, Rob, too, you were talking about coming out of the pandemic. This one of the big trends this year in 2022 is the people who retired during the pandemic unretired this year. Mm-hmm. So there was a real movement of people. And so I think this question that you're talking about today with your listeners about Social Security does come into play for a lot of people who did take early retirement, perhaps during the pandemic, or retired simply because they chose to, but may have started Social Security. And then when they got the jitters this year, decided to get back into the workplace. And then what do you do with your, if you've already started Social Security? So there are some moves that people can do there if they talk to the Social Security Administration or financial planner.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Carrie Hannon is a personal finance and retirement expert, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. Her books include In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. She joined us for a look at Social Security.